Hi, this is Stanley Lee of the New Way Opinion, and I'm recording this introduction before we get to the interview with Jody Emery, which is a pretty prominent activist in the marijuana legalization community. The reason that we recorded this interview is that we've noticed that the Emerys of the cannabis culture got caught in a marijuana raid by the Toronto police on both cities in Toronto and Vancouver. And even though I personally don't like the smell of the substance, don't really care about the substance, there seems to be a lot more than what the mainstream media is telling us. So I thought it would be neat to set up an interview with Jody and kind of pick her brain a little bit. And my impression of the phone call was that there's a common misconception that stoners are, they get dumber, they smell bad, or they can't think well. From my phone call with her, I would say she's probably smarter than a lot of people that I've met and quoted a lot of really credible research from her brain. So even if you don't like weed or don't really care about it, I think this o interview would be an eye-opener, at least in terms of how our society works in terms of incentives with public officials and other politicians. So I hope you would enjoy this interview. Can you tell me a little bit, or rather our audience, a little bit more about you and whatever you've done so far in fighting cannabis prohibition in the first place?
In the year 2004, I moved to Vancouver and started spending time at Mark Emery's BC Marijuana Party bookstore, which is a political headquarters and a head shop. And it was also where the Cannabis Culture magazine was edited and produced. So in 2005, I became the assistant editor of Cannabis Culture magazine, and Mark Emery and myself, we edited it together for a number of years. It was Mark Emery's magazine and business, along with Pot TV, which is one of the first video websites ever made on the internet in the year 2000. But when I came in 2005, in 2004, I started by protesting and joining in the rallies to protest prohibition and writing letters to newspapers and just taking general activism steps. And then in 2005, I became the assistant editor. And later that year, Mark Emery was arrested in Canada by American agents to face life in prison for financing legalization with his marijuana seed business. So Mark Emery from 1994 to 2005 sold marijuana seeds to Americans and people around the world and used the millions of dollars that were raised to finance court challenges, global marijuana marches, suing the U.S. government on behalf of American patients and all sorts of causes. So the U.S. government arrested him in Canada in 2005 to face life in prison for that. At that time, Mark and I were involved together romantically, and I was being trained to help run the entire business. So from 2005 until 2009, I just learned how the head shop worked. And after the seed business closed, we opened up the first vapor lounge in 2006. So the Vapor Lounge model was built out, and Cannabis Culture magazine was still being printed, and I was still doing all of that work, and also running for office in 2005 and 2008 with the BC Marijuana Party. And then I was invited to run for the BC Green Party in 2009. I was the policing and crime critic as well. And in 2009, Mark accepted a plea deal with the U.S. to serve time in the U.S. for 5 years rather than life. So I became the owner of Cannabis Culture in late 2009. And in May 2010, Mark was extradited to the United States, where he spent 4.5 years in prison. I visited him regularly, every other weekend or every month if I was busy, because I also ran for the BC Green Party again in 2013. I helped the Washington State Legalization Initiative in 2012. I often organize rallies and events with my team that I've had all this time, and just been a very high-profile activist for many years, 13 years this April. So that's what I do most of the time. I was overseeing the latest expansion of cannabis culture into a model of dispensaries, but for all adults to access. So we were trying to demonstrate what legalization looks like with respect to what the cannabis consumer wants and deserves. And it's an open storefront with a lot of variety and great quality, great prices, happy employees, happy customers, and no discrimination against the healthy or the sick, and no membership or doctor's fees or anything required. Just free choice in a free market. And that's what cannabis culture started doing last April 29th when we opened the first store. In the years since, we've been raided in a number of times at different locations with the franchise model we were building out. And many locations would reopen right away because Mark Emery's activism approach was always to reopen every time he got raided, even before all of this began back in the 90s when he was arrested and charged for selling pop books and magazines and vaporizers and bongs and opening head shops. Everything was illegal, and Mark just never gave up. So in 2012... the Liberal Party decided to support legalization as a party policy. And in 2014, I joined the Liberal Party to run as a candidate, nomination candidate in Vancouver East. So the Liberal Party had promised that anyone could run for office, you just have to apply and win the vote. So I spent more than a year campaigning and supporting the Liberal Party, which is run by Prime Minister Justin Trudeau, who admits he uses marijuana. And I help support this party and get them elected. We raised thousands of dollars and got thousands of members signed up, and it's understood by all that we helped them win the election. Unfortunately, since that time, well, my own nomination was rejected. I wasn't the actual candidate for the election. They chose a lawyer instead, but you know, they didn't even let me run for the vote. In fact, it was a scandal of nominations being denied.
You're talking about their green light committee and whatnot, right?
Yes. Yeah, that's right. So the Green Light Committee said no to me, so I didn't run for them. But I still campaigned for the Liberals and helped them win. And after that, I went to the Liberal Senate Forum in Ottawa, and I sent a formal letter requesting involvement in helping with legislation being drafted. But at the same time, we were also using our longstanding method of peaceful civil disobedience to demonstrate what legalization should look like in the form of recreational dispensaries for adults 19 and older. But it was very public, and we are very high profile, so the whole country watched for months as more and more shops opened every month across Canada. Many of them got shut down with law enforcement. Others just get tickets and by law enforcement. But it was up until just recently where I was overseeing all of cannabis culture's business operations, and now I am I was arrested, and now I face a very stiff penalty of life in prison for overseeing, allegedly, these shops and these businesses that we had no shame about discussing. So I've got an extensive activism history behind me, and much more still to come.
I got a couple of follow-up questions for you, though. Now, technically, right now, cannabis is still a criminal, I think, criminal offense, whether it, you carry them or you sell them and whatnot, right?
Mm-hmm, yeah, marijuana is still completely illegal.
If it's still illegal, I mean, if it's still a criminal offense right now, although the merits it's could be debatable by different people, how is that civil disobedience?
Mm-hmm. Well, the only way that marijuana laws have changed anywhere is because people have willingly broken those laws openly and been arrested and gone to court and won in court. So in Canada especially, the only reason we have medical marijuana legal in this country is because patients and growers and dispensaries got arrested, went to court, and won in court. And the courts ordered the government to allow more access and to allow patients the right to grow. So even with respect to things like marijuana magazines and books, in Canada, it's illegal to sell a book or magazine about marijuana. It's called Section 462.2 of the Criminal Code. It also bans vaporizers, bongs, pipes. So in fact, everything about marijuana is illegal in Canada, unless you have a license from Health Canada, which has only been won through court victories. So the need to use civil disobedience is demonstrated by the fact that the government never willingly gives people more access. They're only ever ordered by the court to provide access. So victims have to go to the court after being arrested. So even with other civil liberties issues, such as women's right to vote. You know, women went to the ballot boxes and demanded the right to vote, and they were dragged out by police officers and told the law is the law. It's illegal. You don't get to vote. The same thing happened with abortion rights, where Dr. Henry Morgenthaler in Canada opened up an abortion clinic and provided abortions because women were getting hurt by the prohibition of it. And he broke that law and he suffered for it, but he also won the Order of Canada. And you look at other causes like, you know, the right to free slaves. It was illegal to free slaves, but a lot of people broke that law because that law was unjust. And when you think the law is the law, well, the Jim Crow laws were also laws, and it was the law to discriminate against Black people. So the law isn't always right. And when there is no victim, there should be no crime. Cannabis has no victims. It's only criminalized because of the government's own choice to define it as criminal. If the government just decriminalized or legalized, it's not criminal, and therefore people can just use it and sell it and deal with it like any other product. But when the government makes it criminal, we become the victims, and that's the law is the law. Well, the law is unjust, and it takes good people breaking unjust laws to make change happen. And Rosa Parks is a great example. And while I'm not comparing the situation or the persecution in detail of the different causes, the idea is that you have to have people willing to break unjust laws. In fact, Martin Luther King Jr. also said the same. One has a moral responsibility to disobey unjust laws or break unjust laws. So when it comes to a law that hurts people and tears apart families and costs taxpayers billions of dollars, suppressing a multi-billion dollar industry that's mostly run by peaceful, nonviolent people, you know, that government's policy and that law is wrong. And the reason we have so much progress is only because of lawbreakers willing to bravely do that and change the law.
Okay, so I guess the argument is that just because something is legal doesn't mean that it's moral, right?
Right. And I mean, I don't have a problem with laws that protect us from murderers and thieves and fraudsters and rapists. You know, there's crimes out there that are right. But those crimes all have victims. When it comes to marijuana prohibition, the only victims are the people who are getting arrested. Right. The victims are the people who are being punished by the drug laws. And I mean, especially people of color and people who are poor. Like, these are different groups that are mostly persecuted unfairly. And that sort of civil liberties issue makes this cause worthwhile. So people aren't, you know, we're not necessarily protesting for the right to smoke pot. We're protesting for the right to be free from arrest for making that choice.
So would that be your ultimate goal with respect to fighting cannabis prohibition?
Yeah, my ultimate goal is for no one to get arrested and to no longer be criminalized or demonized. The people who use cannabis all over the world are still treated like scum, and they suffer a lot of propaganda and misinformation. And people who get arrested for pot, they lose their jobs, they can lose their kids, their right to travel, their right to have a scholarship. People are drug tested at work, and if they smoke pot, they lose their job. Even if they're wonderful employees, they can lose their job just for smoking pot. So marijuana users are second-class citizens in society, and the government has been waging a propaganda war against us for decades, and they still are today. It's worse than ever in Canada. They're lying about saying that shatter is explosive, that you know, this, that a lot of these victims of dispensary robberies are to blame, when it's really the thieves and the robbers to blame. But they're turning around and blaming dispensaries, who are the victims of these thefts. So you're seeing a massive coordinated misinformation campaign by these prohibitionists, who are still trying to justify their multi-trillion-dollar, multi-decade-long war on drugs, which is just a war on people and plants. So that's what we're seeing, is a massive crackdown from people who are not interested in letting this civil liberties crisis be truly explored and exposed for what it is.
So, Jody, when you say propaganda, do you believe that there's a lot of big money influence involved in this cycle?
Absolutely. A lot of corporate interests are making no secret about the fact that they want to usurp the industry and take it away from the people who have been growing it for decades. So you're seeing that a lot of former prohibitionists and police and these types who are connected to government, they're getting greedy, and they want to have their own control over this plant while they continue to throw everyone else in jail. So it's doubly immoral and corrupt and evil for these companies and these people on the stock market to be capitalizing from cannabis while they continue to criminalize everybody else. I mean, this is not the dot-com boom. This is not an emerging industry that doesn't exist. It's a multi-billion dollar industry involving millions of people and consumers and growers who are all happy to engage with each other, but hunted down like dogs and treated like scum. And the government lies about how it hurts people. They lie about the growers and the consumers, and they spread fear and misinformation, and that causes real harm, especially right now where there's an opioid crisis and fentanyl, and people are dying throughout North America because of these pain-killing drugs that pharmaceutical companies and doctors sell. But cannabis access reduces opiate overdoses, and that these people who are able to get dispensaries and medical marijuana, they're able to not die from the opioid crisis. So every time a government like the Liberals say they want to restrict and limit access to marijuana, they're saying that more people should die from opioids, and more people will suffer the harms of alcohol use as an enjoyable recreational substance. But, you know, these governments are forcing people to literally die in pain, waiting for a safer choice that's being denied to them.
Let's circle back to the Trudeau Liberals. First of all, originally, why were you so confident that they were going to push forward for legalizing cannabis? And what's happening right now, do you believe that there's stall tactics involved, or what's happening?
I think the Liberals, well, they won me over because I knew that Trudeau smoked marijuana, so I thought he might be open-minded about this. And the general conversation in the public was that marijuana should be legal, so let's get on with it. Because, as you know, in the U.S., in Washington, Colorado, they were voting that year when the Liberals supported legalization at their convention. So everybody just felt like legalization was coming. I was even joking many times about how I was out of work as an activist because there was no more propaganda, no more debate. Everyone agreed it should be legal, and that was great. So I supported the Liberals, thinking that, you know, they really would follow through on this. And they dangled this promise because they knew it would get votes. They noticed in, you know, the United States that people show up in droves to vote for pot.
In terms of electoral maneuvering, right?
Yes, absolutely. They made no secret it was one of their top policies during the election campaign.
Right now, they're trying to make the most amount of electorate happy. But I guess,
right,
according to their calculus, the cannabis prohibition crowd might just not be significant enough for them to service, right? Or
I thought, like, the general public agrees with legalization, but then the government agents and police started spreading misinformation and scaring people about pot and talking and doctors coming out saying it makes people go crazy. And all this propaganda started coming back after years of not seeing it. So the public starts to get scared and they read these stories and then they think, oh no, we need to be protected from marijuana because the government keeps saying it's dangerous, it's dangerous. We'll have to protect you. So all the public that were just generally on the fence and didn't know much, they're now being, lied to in order to justify restrictive regulations and these dispensary raids. So, the government is definitely looking to delay this process. They admit that it won't be legal until right before the next election, which makes it another great promise for them to try and win votes with. But really, I don't believe they're going to properly legalize it at all. I think they're demonstrating a desire to keep the police budgets fully funded and to keep demonizing cannabis. And they just announced, I think, $10.5 million the government just announced today in the federal budget that they're going to be spending on marijuana information campaigns. And based on what they already put out there, it's a lot of misinformation and fear mongering. But again, they need to do that to justify what will be very prohibitionist regulations. They don't want to normalize cannabis. They don't want it widely available. So they're going to spread information to try and achieve that goal.
I mean, in terms of safety, I think everything is it's real it will with relations to context, and also I guess politically, maybe it kind of served a purpose. I mean, federally with the NDP, they've had decriminalization for nearly 4 decades, while the Conservative Party just passed like a motion like last year in their constitution to not care about criminality of cannabis. But before we move on to the next question, you mentioned about about the role of law enforcement or former law enforcement personnel placed in this industry. What kind of evidence do you have to support that?
Well, there's a list of former law enforcement officials, drug cops, and others who are involved in licensed producer marijuana companies. So that list is going around on the internet, and it includes former politicians and cops who are now trying to make money from the licensed producer system. But you also see that Bill Blair is the former top cop of Toronto. He oversaw the G20 crackdown, which was Canada's biggest mass civil rights violation and arrests all at once. And so he actually has been a very bad cop, and he's in charge of the legalization task force. So when Trudeau got elected in late 2015, there weren't many dispensary raids at all because the cops said they had other priorities. Time and time again, they said, "We have other priorities. We're not interested," because everyone knew legalization was probably going to happen. And then in early 2016, the licensed producers started lobbying the government, and they were in the news multiple times admitting it, saying that they were meeting with Bill Blair and they were meeting with the legalization task force members and the Liberal government to lobby to be the only providers of recreational marijuana when it's legal. And they said they would lobby Bill Blair to raid dispensaries and shut them down. And Justin Trudeau himself said that the police must enforce the law and raid dispensaries to shut them down. So Bill Blair has spent all of last year and all of this year going across Canada on a tour and meeting with police chiefs and city governments and telling them that the law is the law, enforce the law, spend the money, and we will need more money when it's legal to do even more enforcement. So they're not even looking at cutting police budgets that they waste on prohibition enforcement. They're looking at maintaining those budgets and adding to it with new things like drug driving laws and other, not growing with the government's permission. So they're admitting they're going to start cracking down more, and that probably means raiding people's houses for growing. And so everywhere Bill Blair has been across Canada on his tour, the police raid dispensaries within a day or two. So it just seems that, with 200 raids since Trudeau got elected, since Bill Blair got put in charge, and since the LPs got to him, we've seen nothing but a misinformation demonization campaign against dispensaries and a promotion campaign for the licensed producers.
So essentially, the local police forces are essentially just following orders from the conditions of their federal funding, right?
I think so. I think it's fair to say that with the RCMP policing most of Canada's jurisdictions and police groups like Toronto Police, who are willing to crack down in a very heavy way, they've all been saying repeatedly, we want some federal clarity. So now the federal government is making it clear they want the police to shut down dispensaries and keep arresting people. So we've had like 50,000 arrests since Trudeau got elected. 200 raids and a lot of people suffering punishment for what's supposed to be legal in the near future.
Okay, let's move on to the questions about the misconceptions now, or rather the miscommunication. First of all, are you, with respect to the Chinese Canadian community, they are especially, like they have especially strong position with respect to cannabis. I think mainly because of, like, a lot of them don't like the smell, including me. However, I personally don't really care about this topic. Now, first of all, are you familiar at all about the history of the Opium War in China?
I have some basic understandings, but I know that if, when we're talking about cannabis and the Chinese voting community, they are typically not in support of any drugs because there's just drugs are bad and they're illegal, and that's a very strong voter bloc.
Well, a lot of them were actually, they got traumatized quite hard with the hist with the what happened with the Opium War, like, or who or with whoever, whichever family member that they feel like they that got hurt with the drugs, so they, I guess they kind of lump it with that category. So what do you want to tell them with respect to cannabis, knowing about this history?
Well, all around the world, for many decades, marijuana has been the poster plant or the poster drug used to represent all illegal drugs. So when you travel internationally and you see a sign at the airport that says no drugs or no drogas or it's always a pot leaf that's included. So the marijuana leaf has been used as a symbol for illegal drugs for a very long time. But most people should know that cannabis is a plant that has been used safely by humans for thousands of years, and that even in China, there are buried people with old cannabis and old cannabis seeds, and that the hemp cannabis plant has been used all over the world for clothing, for food, for medicine, for spiritual purposes, and that some drugs do cause harm and hurt people, but marijuana does not cause harm or hurt people. So we should not group cannabis in with these drugs that have caused misery and suffering for people, because cannabis is a special plant of its own. And it can help those people who use other drugs. But it takes a long time for people to learn the new information that comes out. There's a lot of science and evidence to show that cannabis is not harmful. But people have been told for a very long time that it is. So it will take a very long time for them to understand that it's not. So the information campaign, we have to work hard to talk about what this plant is. And then we also have to talk to the parents. I would say to these parents who are concerned that getting arrested for marijuana is far more harmful than marijuana will be. So if they are concerned about their children, teenagers using marijuana, the biggest concern is that you get arrested for it and then you can't go to school and you can't travel. So it's the law that causes more harm than the actual marijuana itself. And that if we're open and honest and look at marijuana for the plant that it is, I think a lot of people will be very fascinated to find how deep its roots go for all countries, in China especially.
Okay, there's another. We're going to cover the question about minors and cannabis, but there's also another prevalent argument that cannabis. It's a starter drug that a lot of people do end up moving on to harder drugs like cocaine, LSD, heroin, etc. So how would you respond to this?
Well, the gateway drug theory has been disproven many times in recent years. The only way that it's valid is when you talk about how, when you make a bunch of things illegal and you need one of those things, when you go get that one thing, you're going to see all the other things that are illegal. So when it comes to drugs, if somebody wants to get marijuana in a place where it's very illegal, the person who's selling marijuana might sell other illegal things too. So you might be offered some cocaine or something else. But there are different drug user types, like cocaine and ecstasy, and there's more uplifting party social drugs like that. And then you have people who are interested in downers and being relaxed and calm, and that's with opiates and morphine and heroin. And then you have psychedelics like LSD, which you mentioned, and mushrooms. And these other psychedelics are different. They're not addictive. You don't use it, get hooked on them at all. So the people who are introduced to those hard drugs through a dealer, that's prohibition to blame. It's the illegality to blame. If people wanted to just get marijuana, they could just go to a marijuana store. But instead, if it's illegal, they have to go where other illegal things are available. But with respect to the actual science of the gateway theory, there's no evidence to show that when you use marijuana, you suddenly want to use other drugs. In fact, most people who use marijuana used alcohol first as their first drug, as the gateway drug. They go to a party and they drink, and then somebody offers marijuana. So a lot of people will start with alcohol as a gateway drug. But marijuana users don't usually use a lot of other drugs. They mostly like just smoking pot. So they're not going to go inject heroin because they're just not interested in it. They just like to smoke pot.
There's also a prevalent argument about the addictive nature of cannabis. I mean, how addictive
Well,
is it compared to alcohol or tobacco? How many studies are there
oh.
about this?
There's a lot of studies about it, and marijuana is not addictive. It's not physiologically addictive, I think is the word, where your body does not become dependent on it. So for people who drink coffee, you become very addicted to it, and when you don't have it, you get headaches, you feel sick, you have immediate withdrawal effects if you don't drink coffee one day, if you usually drink it every day. And people who are alcoholics have the same thing. If they don't get alcohol, they will be violently ill and not well. But for a marijuana user, if you don't have marijuana, you're not going to be sick. It won't make you ill. Unless you're a medical marijuana patient and you don't have your medical marijuana, then you will get sick, but that's
Because
because
of
of
the
your
pain,
illness, not
right?
because of the pot. Right. So with marijuana, though, it's not actually addictive in a physical way, but there are people who might be habitual users, or that it becomes a regular thing that they do all the time. But I would say that's similar to people who exercise all the time, who go to the gym every single day, or they go bike riding or jogging every day, or people who play video games all day, every day. I mean, some people can create a dependency on the habit or the ritual or the pleasure from that ritual. But when it comes to the actual plant matter itself, it does not get people addicted to the plant matter. So that's also been disproven.
Okay, now let's get to the difference between tobacco and cannabis. You've already covered about the addictive or the withdrawal nature of the different substances. Now, if you do use cannabis, your head usually goes really light, and do hallucinations like happen?
Not necessarily. No. If
Because
you eat a lot of cannabis food, maybe you might have kind of hallucinations, but you need to eat a lot.
the next question is, if you're really high on cannabis, aren't there similar issues with with impaired driving, as let's say alcohol?
Okay, so with the tobacco comparison, we'll do that one first. Is that tobacco cigarettes are chemically altered. There are a lot of toxic chemicals added to it by the cigarette companies, and that's what's actually hurting people. Traditional tobacco plant matter is not nearly as dangerous. It's the cigarettes that are made that are very deadly and very dangerous, and there's evidence of that. There's straight up
So,
evidence time and time again of cigarettes actually hurting you, and they restrict the blood flow, so you get cancers. Marijuana, on the other hand, if you want to look up Dr. Donald Tashkin, Tashkin, he was asked by the DEA to prove that marijuana smoke causes lung cancer. And when he studied it for a long time, he came back and said it doesn't cause lung cancer. And in fact, it prevents lung cancer. And if you smoke cigarettes and pot, you're less likely to get cancer than if you just smoke cigarettes. So cannabis actually has a preventative or, a preventative quality that allows cigarette smokers to not die as much as they do if they only smoke tobacco. So cannabis is a vasodilator, which means more blood and oxygen moves around, and that's why
So you're
the science shows that people who smoke pot do not have lung damage. You can find reports on that
so are you
marijuana
saying,
smokers.
sorry, so are you saying those reports and the studies didn't show that cannabis also has those tar stuff that sticks onto the lungs?
Yeah, cannabis does not stick to the lungs that way. There's an expectorant quality, which means people cough up a bit and it clears out their lungs. So there's actual evidence to show that even people who have asthma use cannabis and it opens up their airways. So even gold medal champion swimmer Michael Phelps has the strongest lungs in the world, and he smokes pot too. And same with Usain Bolt, who runs. So marijuana actually doesn't harm lungs, and there's a lot of evidence to show that it does not. It's just that it flies in the face of a very common and reasonable perception that inhaling smoke is bad for lungs. Like, of course, if you can inhale clean air or smoky air, you're better off smoking or breathing in clean air. But marijuana smoke is very unique, and it doesn't cause the harm that people think it does. As for alcohol and driving and impairment, alcohol impairs your judgment. So people think they can drive when they can't. They think they can jump off a building when they can't. They think that girl's into them, but they're not. Your judgment is off. So people don't behave like themselves when they're drunk. So that's why they get in their car and they drive and they're losing the ability to drive because they are impaired. Alcohol is a very big impairment drug. So marijuana, on the other hand, does not impair your judgment. So if you're a marijuana smoker who uses it all the time and you smoke some pot, you'll say to yourself, am I able to drive now or not? And you'll know if you can or not. You're not going to have impaired judgment. If you feel like, hey, maybe I'm too high, I've had four joints tonight after dinner instead of two, or whatever. If you use more and you are in any way impaired, you understand it and you don't mess with it. You choose not to drive. So you don't make bad decisions under the influence of pot the way that you do with alcohol. And there's a great study out there by the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, the U.S. government, where they analyzed a lot of reports and studies into marijuana and driving, and they found the conclusion that marijuana users are no more likely to crash than people who are sober and who have not used any drugs. And we can tell because you would have statistics to show that marijuana users crash, but there is no evidence. You have evidence of alcohol consumers crashing, people on pharmaceutical medication crash because of those drugs, people who use cell phones. They crash because of distracted driving, and you can measure that. You can see the increase in crashes and attribute it to texting and driving, but you can't find any equal comparison for marijuana consumption and driving. So there's more fear about that than proper information. And if people are driving impaired, whether it's by alcohol or pharmaceutical drugs, or they're tired or they're on their phone, I mean, if you're distracted and driving unsafely, there are already laws on the books to deal with that. You don't need to introduce all new laws to deal with marijuana alone, But that's what you're seeing the police and different drug test companies really pushing for in regulations.
Okay, how would you respond to the argument that legalization of cannabis encourage more people to smoke more weed?
Well, it's understood that a lot of people choose not to use marijuana because it's illegal and they don't want to break the law. They don't want to get arrested. So a lot of people will probably choose to try it once it is legal, but not that many. They found that in the United States, where it was legal, most marijuana smokers were already smoking marijuana.
When it was
There weren't a
illegal, right?
whole There weren't, yeah, there aren't a whole lot of new users, especially not a whole lot of young new users. But they do see an increase in seniors because a lot of seniors are using a lot of different pills that are very expensive, and they're choosing to eat a marijuana brownie instead. And so you see an increase in medical marijuana users for sure.
Rather than
And some,
opioids, right?
right, exactly, rather than all the painkiller pills instead. So people are substituting those drugs with cannabis. And some people say, well, we shouldn't legalize it to promote it. In fact, the liberals are saying that a lot. We don't want to promote it. We don't want it to be everywhere. We don't want to normalize it. Whereas advocates like me, we think we should normalize it. We should promote it. It's a safer choice. It should be available to people, and we should create jobs, and we think it should be promoted. So that's a confrontation for the future, is that when the government does legalize it in some way, shape, or form, we still have to fight back against all the misinformation and to promote it because it is safe and it is very useful for a lot of purposes.
I mean, speaking of legalization and safety, my next question is how does the public know whether the substance is safe? Because I believe that, and many people do believe that we do need laws and regulations and enforcement to ensure the safety, right? So how do we
Well,
know if it's
marijuana has
safe?
been grown for a long time without any harm. There's no evidence of marijuana victims. So it's already been done safely for a very long time. But I compare it to like a farmer's market. How do I know for sure that all that food is safe? I don't, but I trust that they're doing it right. And if they're not, somebody will get hurt and then the law enforcement or bylaw enforcement will come in and deal with it. But for the most part, marijuana growers are proud of their product. And the only bad toxic marijuana that's being grown now that's hurting people is the licensed producer marijuana, which does have pesticides on it. And they are being sued by veterans and patients for hurting them with bad marijuana. So, the overregulation is not necessary. Now, I can only answer one more question, so you got to choose which one that's going to be.
Okay, let me just.
Yeah, we're getting
Okay,
close to an
I
hour
got
here,
it, I
which is
got it.
good.
I got it.
Okay.
Now, you don't have children, right?
No.
So if hypothetically, if you do have children, at what age do you think they can use cannabis if they choose to? There's a lot of parents that equate substances with other behaviors like watching porn or smoking cigarettes. So how is it any different?
Well, teenagers will do a lot of things that their parents do not want them to do. And, you can't stop them from doing it, even if it's illegal. And we see that. Teenagers are going to do what they're going to do. So it's best to be honest and open with them about the truth about cannabis and the truth about all these different things, about, sexting or whatever it is that parents have to worry about. I think the age of 16 is appropriate because it's the age of consent. It's the age when you start to drive. It's the age when you can join the military. I mean, there's a lot of things you can do at that age. And in 2002, the Senate of Canada released a massive report called the Senate Report. They analyzed marijuana for years because it was going to be decriminalized by that Liberal government back then. So they looked at it and they came back and they said it's safe. It should be the age of 16. So I side with the Liberal Senate on that. But And I understand how voters are, and I understand how people get scared, and they've been lied to about pot, so they're scared. So we think that 18 is reasonable. That's what the task force report recommended. The cannabis culture stores were 19 and older because that's the age for buying liquor, and most people just think, hey, if you can buy booze, you should be able to buy pot. So that's the model that cannabis culture was going with, but also 18 is what the task force report recommends. So, but I believe that mature, responsible teenagers who don't have any issues of drug dependency or problematic behavior, they should be allowed to choose cannabis at the age of consent.
What are you working on without cannabis culture right now?
I'm just going to work on activism and doing a cross-country tour and probably a big lobbying effort in a group to unite the victims of prohibition and the cannabis culture and community to, you know, make sure that we don't get stomped out while these big business boots come marching in.
So we should just link to your social media profiles, essentially, right?
Yeah, my Twitter feed's where I'm most active, and I'll get an updated website on jodiemery.ca eventually. Got to just, you know, start focusing on all that stuff because I was so busy with the work.
Okay, well, thanks for your time.
Of course. Thank you for the great questions. It's really a good chance to speak to your audience, so I appreciate that.
I hope you enjoyed the interview, and as you've heard, go ahead and click on any of her the links that we've enclosed in this interview. Now, just to disclose, I did ask her a question over email that I didn't have a chance to ask on the phone call. It has to do with the cannabis legalization models. I asked her to comment on the Washington, Colorado, and the Amsterdam model, and she did reply that the models in various jurisdictions are often overly restrictive and punitive. Amsterdam's coffee shops have been closed in large numbers in recent years because of prohibitionist rules. Washington closed many dispensaries too. Colorado is the best of all current models, but it too also has flaws. I guess from reading her response and from just thinking over the phone call, I guess it's a battle of really between public knowledge of the substance and the interests of drug companies, public officials, and whoever else is involved in the industry. So even if you take nothing out of this and you still hate the smell of weed, conflict of interest, and shady political campaign financing affects every aspect of our lives. So I hope you find this interview interesting, and stay tuned. We will get more phone calls with interesting personalities.